How many of you are interested in this seminar? If we forget the amount of people that have come to charge their phones, how many people in the seminar were interested by the title of the seminar? Great. Good. Good. I thought a little bit about why I would talk about what I was going to talk about. And hopefully as I kind of go along, it'll kind of come out. What is truth? Something that people have thought about for thousands of years. The brightest minds in the world have thought about what is truth, what does it mean, what does it mean to be true, what does it mean to speak truth. But these are also the words that were uttered from one man to another in the privacy of a one-to-one conversation. One man stood in front of another, and it was Pilate to Jesus, and it was a matter of hours before he was crucified. And Pilate is asking the questions he needed to of a man that was on trial in front of him. And he's possibly asking him, he's possibly trying to find a reason not to sentence Jesus to death, or he's possibly scorning him for the fact he isn't answering his questions, or it's possibly none of the above. But he's there and he's asking these probing questions. And the probing question at the center of it is, what is truth? Now, I think we are naturally born believers. Not believers in God, I'll leave that to one side. But as in, we naturally believe things. We're born with a predisposition to believe things. As children, we believe that dragons live at the bottom of caves. We believe that a fairy exchanges our teeth for money. And we believe that Santa Claus is responsible for all our presents at Christmas. I'm really sorry if that is a revelation to someone, but it's not true. See everyone leave. There you go, there's some leaving already. Boo. Anyway, as children, our imaginations, well, they kind of run wild with possibility. We think kind of unhindered, boundaryless thoughts. We don't necessarily think of what things are like, but we think of what things could be. And one thing we never do as children is we never put things in a box. And then we begin to experience things. And experience leads us to kind of question things. And we question things, and suddenly our belief in Santa Claus isn't as strong as it used to be, because we realize that actually delivering presents to 1.2 billion children in 12 to 18 hours just doesn't work, whichever way you think of it. And we learn about geology, and we realize that actually when we get to the bottom of caves, there aren't dragons there. Or if there are, they're a lot smaller, a lot more manageable than we thought they were. And also when we wake up in the middle of the night to find our parents sneaking a pound coin under our pillow, our belief in the tooth fairy suddenly becomes a bit more shaky. I don't know if my daughter's here. Is she? No, my wife's shaking her head. That's fine. She probably would have hated if I told you this. But if I give my daughter a piece of paper and tell her to draw a picture of our family, or if I tell her to draw a picture, chances are it'll come back and it'll be a picture of our family. And it'll be me. I'm the one in the middle, the big round thing, with a really big head and the arms coming out the knees and all this sort of stuff. She's 3 and a half. She's not really bad at drawing. But there'll be me. There'll be my wife. There'll be Lucy, our daughter. There'll be Bethany, our other daughter. There'll be Reggie, the dog. Then there'll be an aeroplane. Then there'll be a tumble dryer. Then there'll be Mr. Tumbles. Then there'll be a bowl of pasta. Then there'll be elephants. Then there'll be all sorts of stuff. And for Lucy at 3 and a half years old, the possibility of what can be in a picture is endless, because her experience hasn't dictated to her what is and isn't possible. As she grows older, she realizes that elephants don't live in Cambridge, Mr. Tumble has never been or probably will never come to our house. And as she gets older, her picture fits more and more into her realm of experience. Now, as we experience more, we believe less. Who's a football fan? Woo! Yeah, you know that in a football match, the experienced player is usually the one at the back. I'm kind of thinking Tony Adams. Tony Adams, he's the guy at the back, the thin in hair, the scars on his face, the one who looks like he's had more yellow cards than you've had hot dinners. But if we kind of compare that to the way that we are with our belief, it's like in a way we become more uncompromising. We become that sort of gnarly experienced player as time goes on. We become skeptical. New ideas will never work because we've seen it all done before. We know what's worked. We know what doesn't work. Experience tells us it doesn't work that way. We lose belief in what is possible. And so as we go through life and experience grows, belief and trust diminish. When we have our hearts broken, we trust less. When a friend doesn't pay us back our money, we believe in that person less. This continues throughout our lives until we are left not really knowing what to believe. We start asking fundamental questions about what is it to believe? What is truth? And we become less transfixed with the rights and wrongs of a situation and become more concerned about how that situation makes me feel. In essence, we kind of sacrifice fact for feeling. I'm going to talk about politics for a second. Don't be offended. I've tried to be balanced. If I have, great. If I haven't, I'm sorry. I don't know how you voted. If you can vote, if you didn't vote, I don't really mind. Don't really care. But if you voted, fantastic. If you didn't vote, vote next time. Three statements from the last 2 years. Vote Leave and give £350 million a week to the NHS. Second one, each UK household will be £4,300 worse off if the UK leaves the EU. And within 100 days, I'll deport all the illegal immigrants living in America. Three quotes from the last 2 years. Three quotes from possibly two of the most seminal moments in the last 25 years or longer of politics. Trump and Brexit. As I say, I don't know how you voted. It doesn't matter how you voted. Two very different things, two things that have got in common. They're coming from very different standpoints, but what they've got in common is that they are all patently untrue. They were false. They were intended to be false. The people behind them knew they were false. They were written and they were false. But people delivered them and asked people to believe them. We aren't able to give £350 million a week to the NHS because that money doesn't exist. No one's going to be £4,300 worse off unless a certain set of circumstances happens for everyone in the country. And there is absolutely no chance that Donald Trump can get rid of 11 million illegal immigrants in 100 days. Just doing the maths behind that was today, that wouldn't work. It's 152,000 a day when you take out all the weekends. If you split that across 400 immigration officers in America, that makes it 382 deportations every day. Bear in mind, a deportation takes between 10 and 15 days is the quickest you can get anyone out of America. It means that more likely the figure is about 100,000 people in 100 days. The statement is inherently untrue, and yet they were all believed. Mark Twain said, "A lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes." They were all believed because they didn't play to the objective, factual, and reasoning part of our characters. It's because they all played to our emotions. We don't want to believe facts. We want to believe whatever fits in with our own situation and our reality. Honesty is no longer the best policy. It's telling people what they want to hear. With Brexit and Trump, looking back with hindsight, we can say the truth never really stood a chance. Like we were and we continue to be in the midst of a post-truth world. Post-truth is the abandonment of facts and reasoning around an issue. We prefer instead to allow our emotions to guide our responses. And this, twinned with our kind of life experiences, it reduces our tendency to believe and trust. And it makes some of the most kind of flagrant mistruths just seem believable. And to the mother or father of a midwife or a nurse who's seen their son or daughter struggle on as real-time wages in the NHS falter under kind of the demand of it, having someone make a promise to pull back country's finances and deliver money to the people that you love, it pulls on the heartstrings. To a low-paid worker, barely making enough to stay out of debt, £4,300 a year is massive. And to a worker in America who has just been made redundant, having someone stand up with a policy to say, "I'm going to make it easier for you to get a job," it seems like a policy that's too good to miss. But there's no reason in those three statements that I read out. There's no checking of the facts. There's no unearthing the truth behind them. People believe them because they so much desperately want them to be true. We all search for the truth. And in searching, we'll often convince ourselves that what we've found, however unrealistic or unfeasible, is true. We want to believe that someone will properly fund the NHS. We want to believe that someone will protect my wages. And we want to believe that someone will look after my future job prospects. And as much as we want to believe it because we want it to be true, we've also got to look at the fact that we believe it because we're, in a way, conditioned to believe it. Who's heard of Ivan Pavlov? The man who invented the Pavlova? That's your one joke you're not getting anymore. He didn't invent the Pavlova. He's famous for his experiments with dogs and regarding conditioning. And knowing that dogs would salivate when you offer them a treat, he accompanied giving them a treat with ringing a bell. As the experiment went on, he removed the treat but continued ringing the bell. And the dogs continued to salivate. And the experiment had proven in the end that the association of the bell with the treat was enough to make the dog salivate. However, that was with animals. Pavlov had an idea of, could we do this with humans? Now, he came up with an experiment that absolutely, definitely would not be allowed now. He conducted an experiment called the Little Albert Experiment. Albert was a 9-month-old boy. And he was placed in a room with a number of items, like lots of toys. And there was a car, there was a truck, there was a white kind of fluffy rat, there was a ball, and there was some other bits and pieces. And Albert, he didn't represent any sort of notable side effects to any of these toys at all. One day, while Albert was playing, he got around to playing with the white rat. And behind him, there was this metal bar. And every time he went over to the white rat, Pavlov, or one of the guys with him, would hit this metal bar with his hammer, making such a loud noise. And Albert would begin to cry. And once he'd settled down again, he'd continue to play. But every time he got over to the white rat, he would hit the metal bar again, always without Albert being able to see it. And eventually, Albert began to associate anything that remotely looked like the white rat with fear, and he would cry. And in a way, we're all like little Albert, conditioned by the things around us, encouraged to feel certain things by what we read, what we see, what we hear, what we experience. What's the first thing you think of if I say the words nurse, breadwinner, footballer, or more seriously, terrorist? Chances are you'll think of a female nurse, because experience has led you to think or led you to know that actually the majority of nurses in this country are female. Breadwinner, you probably thought of a man, because traditionally breadwinners in this country have been men. Same with footballers. Chances are we initially think of men. Men's football is more prolific, there's more teams, there's more players, there's bigger sponsors, there's more money involved. And chances are when I said terrorist, your first thought wasn't a middle-aged white woman. What we read and what we hear informs our opinions. Earlier this year, there were three men that attacked the public in Borough Market in London. A week later, there was a man drove a van into a crowd of people outside a mosque in London. But only the first three men were consistently referred to as terrorists. And that's because they were. But the second man who drove a van, because he was from Cardiff, wasn't necessarily always referred to as a terrorist. But like little Albert in the room, we are being told that the white rat is bad because of the noise that is created around it. Certain portions of the written press will have us believe that we should fear certain people because of the noise that they put around them. The Borough Market write-ups in newspapers were being written a week after the attack. Finsbury Park Mosque became a footnote after about 24 hours. And we see what's happening in America. 85 deadly US terror attacks since 9/11, and far right-wing extremists were responsible for 62. Islamic extremists for 23. But a poll from 2015 showed that 55% of Americans had an unfavorable opinion of Islam. But a poll was never taken about whether people had an unfavorable opinion of the far right. The narrative is steered in a certain direction. Stories offered up for us to digest and to believe. Only certain angles are considered. And data is contorted to fit the points it needs to prove. And when the majority of news follows the same narrative, we struggle to see how it could possibly be untrue. But the media isn't the only part of society trying to control the narrative. It appears everywhere. Who's an Ed Sheeran fan? Why are you an Ed Sheeran fan? He's a man who churns out songs faster than chickens lay eggs. His song, Shape of You, anyone like that song? Good, catchy song. Went number one everywhere around the world. But what does it say? This is why my daughter's not here, because she cringes at me saying this. But it says, there's a line where it says, I'm in love with the shape of you, I'm in love with your body. The insinuation being that your body is the key part of who you are. Misguided. Did anyone see that petition on Facebook recently? Anyone sign that petition? Sign in London. Misguided, a shop in the Blue Water Shopping Centre displayed a sign in neon pink prominently in the shop saying, send me nudes with a kiss at the end of it. A look at their website suggests they take the issue of image and female empowerment seriously. But their sign suggests otherwise. A sign interested in female empowerment would say, send me your CV. Or send me your ideas about how we create a society where girls aren't pressurized to send in naked pictures to randy teenage boys. But the sign and its prominence within the shop gives the very real idea that sending nude pictures of yourself is fine, it's accepted, it's what you should be doing. I travelled to work on the underground and saw a sign for a while that said, are you beach body ready? Quite clearly I am, but that wasn't the point. And it was all these pictures of scantily clad men and women, and it's subliminally asking, do you not want to be as slim and attractive as these people? And we see these adverts, we listen to these songs, we visit these shops, and we initially brush these messages off. It doesn't impact me. I don't need to look at this. But as we see more of them, maybe we take a bit more notice. Maybe one day we do look in the mirror, longer than usual, pick the parts of our bodies we don't like. Maybe we'll Google weight loss techniques. Maybe we'll consciously decide to eat less. Through persistence and placement, and playing on the insecurity and weakness of people, adverts and songs begin to dictate our narratives. We find ourselves singing along to Ed Sheeran, taking in the lyrics. What impact does that have on the way we see each other? When you find yourself in a relationship with someone asking you to send pictures of yourself, does that voice in your head say, surely everyone does this? Why should I be different? And if you don't have a beach body, then why would anyone find you attractive? But we buy it and we believe it. And we accept this as truth. We willfully accept myths, truths to be said over our lives. I said it earlier, I'll say it again. We don't want to believe facts. We want to believe whatever fits in with our own situation and reality. What myths, truths do you believe about yourself? What fake news are you believing about yourself? Just sharing a little bit about me. I'm someone who'll always say yes. That's how I ended up doing this seminar. But generally, I like to help people. And for years, I always thought that me saying yes was because of that. I always try and find a solution, and I'll always try and kind of solve problems, even if I end up creating more problems. But I'd say that underneath kind of what might appear to be quite a confident facade, I'm actually quite an insecure person. I underachieved at school, made some silly choices with where I'd spent my time, who I spent my time with, and decided early on that further education at university just wasn't for me. So the irony that then I led the student reception yesterday is not lost on me. Instead, I went overseas, worked for a couple of years, and came back to the UK, got a job actually working with Soul Survivor in Watford, and then I ended up with the job I've got now. And that's quite a quick kind of potted history of my recent life. But what it doesn't tell you is that I get really anxious about my self-worth because I'm ultimately insecure about my worth as a person. My CV, if you see it, is 8 pages long. Now, that's not because I'm good at 8 pages worth of stuff, but it's because for years I've equated what I do with who I am. Be good at what you do, and that's fine. I always say yes, because yes, I genuinely want to help people, but because I think the more I do, the more accepted I become. I fear saying no will lead people to not ask me again. And if they don't ask me again, then I'll end up doing less. And if you do less, and if you equate what you do with who you are, then doing less is a really bad thing. And so I say yes when I should really say no. It's actually a really good job I'm not a woman, because I'd probably be married a lot more than I am. You're all thinking, as if anyone ever proposed to you. And I remember where this came from. When I first started working, my dad, he's no longer with us, but he, probably being genuinely fearful of the jobs market and just wanting to encourage me, he gave me possibly the worst piece of advice I've ever heard in my entire life when it comes to jobs. And he said, make yourself indispensable. Make them think they can't run it without you. And to a 16-year-old starting his first job, that just gave me a license to kind of work all the hours I could, be ambitious to get to the top of the job, embed myself as furniture within the business, effectively building up with me that idea of you do more and you will be more as a person. And we chatted a few years ago, and I told him it wasn't the greatest bit of advice. And he did actually say to me, he said, well, what advice would you give to Lucy when she starts her first job? I said, I would definitely tell her not to listen to her parents. But it's, what are the things that you are believing about your lives? What are the statements you're saying over your lives that aren't true? God won't use me. I'm not confident enough. God can't use me. If only you knew what I'd done. I've failed at this, which is why I can't do that. If only you knew the truth about me, you would know why I'd never be good at doing X, Y, or Z. We don't want to believe facts. We want to believe whatever fits in with our own situation and reality. What is your situation? What is your reality? Do you believe that you aren't good enough for God because you've come from a reality where you're constantly told you aren't good enough? Do you believe that you aren't pretty enough because your reality is that people constantly judge you on your appearance? In John 8, it reads, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. And Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Look at the statements you believe about yourself. Do they set you free? Jesus came to free you from sin, condemnation, and death. He came to free you from the feeling of inadequacy by telling you the truth that you are known and loved. He came to free you from your feeling that you can't achieve anything for God by what you've done, by saying he knows the plans he has for you. God has used people high and low for the service of his kingdom. He knows the truth about you. He knows the very fiber of your being, the very core of who you are. And he still says to you, you are accepted and you are loved. That is essentially the fundamental truth of the gospel. That is truth. In searching for truth, we convince ourselves that what we believe is true. But hold these truths up, and their frailties come to the fore. Father Christmas, he never really stood a chance. Because when weighed up against the evidence, it just didn't stack up. The tooth fairy bit the dust when you look at the facts. But every time we dig into the Word of God, the Bible, we see that time after time after time after time after time, promises are fulfilled, prayers are answered, truth is spoken into people's lives, situations are transformed, and lives are turned around. Winston Churchill kind of very famously said in the House of Commons once, and I'm actually nearly finished. I've only done half an hour, you can go and get an ice cream. Winston Churchill, he said in the House of Commons, he said, the truth is incontrovertible. I had to Google what incontrovertible meant. I didn't have that on my CV. The truth is incontrovertible. It means you can't deny it. You cannot argue with it. It says the truth is incontrovertible. Panic may resent it. Ignorance may deride it. Malice may distort it. But in the end, there it is. Jesus was utterly resented for the message that he brought. He was derided by those who were trying to control the narrative. His words were distorted by the people who were intimidated by him. He was ultimately killed, but in the end, there he is. He is incontrovertible. You cannot argue with it. You cannot deny it. There he is. But we have to choose to believe him. So we come back to that question. What is truth? The words of Pilate as he stood face to face with Jesus. The words of a man caught up between the various narratives about who Jesus was. The world said one thing about Jesus, and Jesus said a very different thing. Who was he to believe? So we keep coming back to what is truth? The living, breathing manifestation of truth is standing right in front of you. He's there, right in front of you. You can trust him. He's literally given you his word that he's everything he says he is. The question that was in front of Pilate is the same question that's in front of us. Do we believe the narrative or do we believe what Jesus is? We don't really know what Pilate decided, but you have an opportunity to think about what you believe. Do you believe the narrative about what is being said about your life? Do you believe the narrative about what the world says about you, what the world says about teenagers? Or do you believe in Jesus, who is the truth? And in that truth, there is freedom. You've got a decision to make. Go with truth, go with the narrative. Amen.